Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. When you visit the city of Newark, it's easy to see its charm and architectural history, the town square that surrounds its vintage courthouse and other turn-of-the-century landmarks. But the older, less obvious landmarks of that region and across the Ohio Valley, the remnants of the largest geometric earthwork complex in the world, constructed 17 centuries ago, those have attracted worldwide attention, and the experts who study these structures are still discovering new elements to them. Coming up on October 24th, a symposium about the earthworks is planned in conjunction with the Midwest Archaeological Conference. It's open to the public. For more information, go to the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Joining us now to talk about the earthworks and their enduring importance in the field of archaeology is archaeologist Dr. Jared Birx of the Ohio Valley Archaeology. Welcome to the show, Jared.
Thanks, Ann.
Also joining us is Dr. Bradley Lepper. He's curator of archaeology for the Ohio Historical Society. Welcome to the show, Brad.
Thank you, Ann.
First of all, can we begin by describing what we mean by the earthworks, what the larger layout of them is, and then what we're talking about closer in when we talk about the Newark earthworks?
Well, there are something like 600 or so enclosure sites in Ohio alone. And of course, these sites extend into some of the surrounding states as well. And most of these sites consist of small individual enclosures. Circles are quite common. And these might be only 100 feet or so in diameter. But they can range up to individual enclosures as much as 1,300 feet across. I think it's the largest single one in Ross County. The Newark Earthworks also has a very large circular enclosure, and Brad's quite familiar with that site.
Yeah, and it's important, I think, to understand that these mounds and earthworks were built over thousands of years by different Native American cultures, or at least archaeologists distinguish differences among them. And the Newark earthworks were built by the people that archaeologists call the Hopewell. And it represents the largest complex of these geometric earthworks ever built by any Native American culture or anybody else in the world, for that matter.
How were they first discovered?
Well, the earthworks were first discovered because, well, they were discovered by European Americans. When they entered the valley and came in and encountered them, they were literally astonished by these gigantic earthworks that they stumbled across.
Yeah, hard not to see them. Some of the embankment walls can be 10, 15 feet tall, and the ditch is just as deep.
And it's immediately apparent that they're man-made.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I would say
for a lot of them.
Sometimes
yeah.
I've seen some that look just like hills from a short distance. From close up, you don't see.
Well, and I think for many people, I tell a story about my wife shopping for a car at a dealership across the street from the Great Circle, and a guy whose office overlooked the Great Circle didn't recognize it as a structure built by people. He didn't see the mound. She said, my husband works over the mounds, and he said, what mounds? And she points at literally the wall of the Great Circle. So I think for Western people, the architecture of the Hopewell is very different from the architecture that we're used to. Instead of being made out of stone and climbing up into the sky like a temple, it sprawls across the landscape in a just an immense way, so that these beautiful geometric earthworks aren't always obvious as geometric earthworks when you see them. But yeah, if you walk around them and walk inside them, yeah, you clearly see them as built monuments, at least we do.
Yeah. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm talking with Dr. Brad Lepper. He's curator of archaeology at the Ohio Historical Society, and also Dr. Jared Birx. He is an archaeologist with the Archaeological Geophysics at Ohio Valley Archaeology. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So you said about 600 sites in Ohio alone. How vast beyond that?
There are Native American-built earthworks all over the eastern United States in particular. And a lot of these were built during the same time period, the same period as they were built here in Ohio. But certainly the vast majority of them seem to occur in the middle Ohio Valley, especially in southern Ohio.
What do you make of that, Brad?
I think there were vast interconnected cosmopolitan cultures here in indigenous times, long before Columbus. Some of these interconnections, like Jared says, when they date to the same time period, there are many similarities between these mounds and earthworks in terms of dimension and style of artifacts that are found with them. But over time, there are different vast differences. There are similarities in that their structures are made out of earth, but the artifacts found with them, the kinds of burial practices change over time.
Well, let's talk about burial practices, because I know it's a common assumption, and wrongly in many cases, that all they are for burial purposes, that they're just big geometric cemeteries. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think the idea for that has probably been handed down to us today from all of the excavations done in the 19th century, which focused really primarily on the mounds. And the goal was to get down into the areas where all of the elaborate artifacts were, and those tended to be associated with burials. Much of the rest of these earthwork sites was left uninvestigated in the 19th century, which is kind of good for us because they're still intact when the sites are still there. Do you think that seems reasonable, that's kind of why folks think that these days?
Yeah, I think it's because of the history of archaeological exploration, just as Jared said, that we've emphasized in the past excavating these mounds, and all the things that have come out in the newspapers in the 1800s and 1900s have been the excavation of burial mounds.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's much more complex than that.
Let's talk about the Newark, the series of mounds in the Newark, the earthworks in the Newark area. They're huge. You said they're the largest.
They're almost unimaginably huge, at least as they were originally built. More than 4.5 square miles were taken up with this gigantic earthwork complex, and it included the large circle that Jared mentioned that's 1,200 feet in diameter. That's 4 football fields stretched end to end. In addition, there was a circle and an octagon. The octagon by itself was 50 acres. There was a square, a giant oval, where there were many of the mounds that could be called burial mounds because there are mortuary remains at the bottoms of those mounds. Nothing's preserved of those. The square is almost entirely gone, but the circle and the octagon and the great circle are still there, still preserved.
If nothing's preserved, then how do you know they were there?
Oh, that's a great question. I think Jared.
Yeah, I was going to say. I always take issue. Yeah, I always take issue with the term nothing.
Gotcha.
There is a lot more to these places that's also below ground. So if you were to drive across Ohio seeking these out, if you happen to go through Newark, easy to see them even from the car dealership across the street. But in most of the areas of Ohio, these places have been flattened by thousands of years of erosion and the last 200 years of agriculture. And even in the 1820s and 30s, they were already, people that were writing about these places were lamenting about how quickly they're disappearing from the landscape. And this word destroyed creeps up quite a bit in the literature. And that's usually where I draw the line. I love to debunk the word destroyed.
Sure, what you can't, word do you use?
Yeah, well, I say difficult to see at the surface.
Leveled, maybe.
Leveled, sure. Flattened, but still the potential for incredible amounts of information to still be there. One of the things we haven't mentioned yet is a lot of these earthwork sites consist of this earthen architecture, but there is also a lot of wooden architecture that used to be located here, buildings that actually did rise from the ground.
Right. I was going to, how was it built? They're not just mounds of dirt. There's other stuff, other structures inside of it.
Sure, yeah. One common kind of architecture was circles of telephone pole-sized posts. I don't know what the biggest post circle is in Ohio, but we recently uncovered one in Ross County at a large earthwork site that was over 300 feet across. There would have been at least 100 of these big posts making a perfect circle.
What do you make of that? What do you think about that, Brad?
Well, I think it means that the architecture at these spaces was more than just what we see today. It included buildings. It included wood henges. The architecture was much more complicated, and the way people used these spaces weren't simply as giant, empty dance grounds. They were a variety of things.
Robert in Plain City, you're on the air. Welcome, Robert.
Hello. Good morning.
Morning. Go ahead.
Well, I think you should ask your guest that these Newark earthworks, which is the largest Hopewell earthworks in the world, the only remaining part of it is now in a golf course and can't be seen by the general public.
Right. That's often criticized. Brad Lepper, how did they wind up in a golf course?
Well, first of all, I want to correct the caller. There's also the Great Circle, which is a magnificent component of the Newark Earthworks that is not a golf course. It's simply a public park.
Yep.
The circle and the octagon were preserved initially because it became the, the voters of Licking County and Newark voted to purchase that land to make it a park, to preserve the earthworks, and to bring the National Guard in. So it became the National Guard's campground. The National Guard restored portions that had been plowed down, and it became their campgrounds for several years. When they left, the community was left with, what are we going to do with this land now? How are we going to support it? And the country club offered to make it a golf course, keep it open to the public, but have a sustainable model for it to be perpetuated into the future. And so that was what was adopted back in 1910. It seemed to be a good idea back then. And in fact, I think we could argue that in 1910, it was a good idea. The country club has been there since then. Back in 1910, they were leasing it from the Newark Board of Trade. In the Great Depression, the Newark Board of Trade went out of existence, and when the courts dispersed the assets, it was given to the Ohio Historical Society. The Ohio Historical Society has continued that relationship with the country club, with the community, and I think we recognize today, I think everybody recognizes today, that we wouldn't put a golf course on a mound now, but it's part of the history of the site. It's part of the legal agreement we have with the country club, and I think we're all working towards providing more access to the public of that spectacular site.
There is an observation point, right?
Yeah. There's a large, I guess you'd call it a platform mound, at the opposite end of the circle from the octagon. And even back in the 1800s, it was called the observatory, because if you got up on it, you could get a good observation view of the earthworks. But Ray Hively and Robert Horn from Earl M. College have sort of rediscovered that the site has important astronomical alignments built into its architecture. So observatory seems like a very good name for that feature now.
Yeah. Thank you, John. I'm sorry, Robert from Plain City. Go ahead.
I was going to say that the way for the public to observe the site now is a kind of, what would you call that construction? It's a, looks like a...
Oh, it's a little observation platform,
yeah,
a wooden platform.
A band director would stand on.
I think of an observation deck or something
that. Near the parking lot that you can climb up on and look out over the earthworks.
Has having the golf course there done any damage per se to the earthworks?
Well, certainly in excavating water lines and so on, there's been some damage. But the site had been damaged before. And again, there's been damage to all of the earthworks all over the state of Ohio. And in the historical context of that site, you know, I think having the golf course there has been one way that that site has been preserved.
Yeah, just look at the rest of Newark and the rest of all those earthworks you mentioned. You can't see those anymore.
And you know about them partly because there was mapping done before what they knew of them then.
Absolutely. The very first publication of the Smithsonian Institution was devoted to answering the question of who built the mounds, and surveys of the Newark earthworks and the earthworks in Chillicothe are an integral part of that publication.
It's still right to refer to these as one of the great wonders. Is it of the ancient world or
these earthworks?
Yeah.
Oh, most certainly. Perhaps the least appreciated great wonder of the ancient world, but in the hopes of ramping up the world's interest in these earthworks, the U.S. is trying to nominate these earthworks to the World Heritage List, and Brad has done a lot of work on that.
That was some years ago, though, wasn't it, in the 1990s that it was first nominated?
It hasn't been nominated yet.
Oh,
it's,
okay.
It was, it's on what's called the United States Tentative List, which is essentially the short list of sites that in the next decade or so the United States will pick from to nominate to the UNESCO, the United Nations Scientific and Cultural Organization, an educational organization. Anyway, they will be nominated to UNESCO for inscription on the World Heritage Site, but that hasn't happened yet. We're working towards that. We have a bunch of partners that we're working with developing that nomination. We hope it moves forward soon.
We are talking about the Ohio Earthworks. There is a symposium planned for October 24th, Ohio Earthworks History Preservation and Archaeotourism. To learn more about that, it is open to the public. You can go to the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll continue our conversation when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Dr. Bradley Lepper of the Ohio Historical Society, where he curates archaeology, and Dr. Jared Burks. He's an archaeologist and director of archaeological geophysics at Ohio Valley Archaeology. We're talking about the Ohio Earthworks, in particular, the ones over in Newark. You might have seen them. If you have questions about them, we welcome them. Comments, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We were talking about this earlier. I read a reference, Brad, I think, that you made to the Newark Earthworks, that its components are not merely arcane symbols, but a gigantic machine or factory, which I thought was interesting, in which energies from the three levels of the Eastern Woodland Indians were drawn together and circulated for some purpose. Can you tell me where you how you came to the conclusion of that? And
sure. Factory actually wasn't my term. That was added by an editor. But I think it's a ceremonial machine. And I think that because just like a car engine, there are different components at Newark. There's a circle and an octagon that includes alignments to the moon. There's a great circle that has a ditch inside it around the inside perimeter that was probably filled with water. None of the other earthworks have that. And it also has a mound at the center of it, which none of the other earthworks have. There was a square, and there was a great oval that had mounds with mortuary activities, sort of the community cemetery probably there. So each one of these components has a separate design and function, but they're all connected by parallel walls of earth that connect one of them to the other in a very complicated way that suggests movement between them was choreographed. And there's only three ways to enter the complex, and those three ways are from three different bodies of water, three different streams that surround the site. So the site's surrounded by water. The only way to come into the site is from those sources of water, and I think that's sort of drawing on the spiritual idea of water as the watery underworld in the traditional Native American cosmos, and the sky world was being brought in through the alignments to the moon at the octagon. So it was a very complicated earthwork at which I think people, they engaged with that architecture for a purpose.
It's
a complicated idea.
It's complicated. No, it's. I love the renderings of the earthworks where they show them in alignment with what they must have looked like back in the day, 17,000 years ago or whatever, when they were complete, in alignment with the moon, and that it's pretty amazing. But it was quite a long time before archaeologists realized there was that connection to them.
Absolutely. And it wasn't archaeologists that discovered the lunar alignments.
Okay.
It was an astronomer philosopher from Earlham College that actually came there to disprove the idea that Stonehenge, for example, was an astronomical observatory. They thought it was just coincidence. But when they studied it, they found all of these lunar alignments that really defined the architecture of the circle and the octagon.
Ed in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you. I read an article, and I can't remember when, a few years ago, that talked about the remains of what looked to be an ancient roadway connected Newark to either Chillicothe or Circleville and their earthwork. And I wanted to know if the gentleman had any information about that or whether that was actually a true article, and I'll listen on here.
Okay, Ed, thanks. So Ed's asking about an ancient road from Newark to Circleville or Chillicothe.
Yeah, that's some work I've done. I've called it the Great Hopewell Road, but it's based on observations of people long ago. We've talked about Squire and Davis and Caleb Atwater from the 1820. Originally, Caleb Atwater said the walls that came out of the octagon, the set of parallel walls that went down to Ramp Creek, he thought those walls might go as much as 30 miles and connect the Newark earthworks with earthworks in that area. And then later, in the 1860s, James and Charles Salisbury followed the walls out of Newark, and they followed them 6.5 miles and said they were still going in a perfectly straight line. And I did my undergraduate work at the University of New Mexico and had studied the Chaco Canyon roads the Anasazi built, or the ancestral Puebloans built, long, straight roads that could go for many miles. And my hypothesis was that if this was a road like that, it also could have gone a great distance. And when you extend that line, it points directly at Chillicothe, the other major center of Hopewell earthwork building, and where the other circle and octagon built by the Hopewell culture is located. So there are ties between Newark and Chillicothe in terms of the material culture, the artifacts, the architecture in terms of the circles and octagons, and I've postulated that there was, in fact, a physical connecting roadway that connected these places.
When you talk about the way it was constructed in Newark, surrounded by these water, the streams and, mm-hmm. And the rivers and so forth, back when they were constructed, is there a sense that those were very different? They were bigger, stronger. Or they could have been just trickles of water. What do we know about those waterways 17,000 years ago?
Yeah, I think they were probably very much like they are today. Okay. Of course, many of them have been channelized by the Corps of Engineers, so the course isn't exactly the same.
Okay.
But I think the volume of water, for at least the ones around Newark, probably the Ohio River was different because of the dams and things that have been built along there. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I'm more familiar with the area in Ross County mm-hmm. around Chillicothe, and I don't think the Sado River, except for when it overflows during flood stage, has moved all that much. In general, there are certain meanders that have been cut off over the years, but otherwise, I think the streams are largely like they were in antiquity.
So let's talk a little bit about the Hopewell and the Adena from which the Hopewell sprung. I mean, it's not a tribe, it's a culture. Can you tell us, a lot of people call it, lots of different things, but what does the Hopewell mean? What does it comprise?
So the challenge for archaeologists has always been, how do you refer to this thing we're studying, these people that built these earthworks? And they seem to be similar to earthworks that are quite some distance away. And these folks managed to bring in raw materials from almost all over the country, from as far away as Obsidian Cliff in Yellowstone Park, from the northern Great Lakes. I think there was a barracuda jaw under a mound at Hopewell Mound Group in Ross County, a barracuda jaw. And that's not the weirdest thing. So how did all of this stuff get to Ohio? And where do we draw the lines to say, oh, these are the Hopewell people? Because they seem to have interacted with so many other people in this area. So these terms, Hopewell and Adena, these are archaeological constructions. Somebody created them. In fact, it was a curator of the Ohio Historical Society that dubbed these cultures the Hopewell and the Adena.
And the Adena came first.
In time. And the name comes from a mound that was actually on Thomas Worthington's estate in Chillicothe. And the Adena are distinct from these things, these folks we call Hopewell, in that as far as archaeologically we can tell, their mounds are constructed in a slightly different way. And in fact, they do have burials within them that go all the way up in the mounds. So when you see a really tall conical mound in the middle Ohio Valley, likely that's an Adena mound. And not all Adena mounds have burials in them, and some have hundreds of burials in them. And that's pretty distinctive from the way that the Hopewell took care of their dead.
So the Adena were first in time. From them came the Hopewell culture, which could have spanned thousands and thousands of miles. We don't know.
Well, at least as far as this Ohio Hopewell thing is concerned, it looks pretty concentrated in several of the river valleys in central Ohio. The Scioto Valley in particular, around the Newark area, is a nice concentration of earthworks. But when you get out into the Muskingum River Valley proper, it seems to drop off to some degree. And there are very few things that are classically Hopewell in the Hocking River, like around Athens. Ohio. So it's really concentrated in the Scioto River, the Licking River, and the Great Miami River and the Little Miami River have a good concentration of earthworks as well.
And if I could just add a thought about the names,
Yeah.
Certainly they are names of archaeological convenience that we've come up with, but we do think they reflect some reality, some changes that took place in ancient times that we're simply describing by giving them different names. And as Jared's pointed out, we think the Adena become the Hopewell in an important sense, but it's changed. And so what archaeologists want to be able to talk about is that change that took place. And if it gives the impression to people that we think different people came in that now have a different name, that's totally an incorrect impression. It's cultural evolution in one place.
Is there something that we can identify culturally in a modern way? Is there a parallel that you could use to describe what you're talking about?
Well, one parallel that I've used for the fact that the Adena and the Hopewell overlap in time, the many people in parts of Ohio continue to practice an essentially Adena way of life while Hopewell is happening in sort of those valleys that Jared talked about, is the Amish people continuing to live a 19th century way of life surrounding urban centers of 21st century Ohio.
They're still modern humans, but they're living a different culture.
Yeah, their religious practices dictate that they do things differently, and that shows up in important ways that archaeologists would see and probably find confusing 1,000 years from now, finding an Amish site and having it date to the same period as Columbus, Ohio.
And even they are scattered all over the place now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what's also challenging is that Amish folks use some of the same material culture that we use too. So you could go to, if you were an archaeologist 1,000 years from now, you could go to an Amish archaeological site, but you could find a pair of scissors that looks just like a pair of scissors at, you know, somebody's backyard in Columbus, Ohio, from the same era. And that's a real challenge in differentiating between Adena and Hopewell. They are kind of the same people, but some groups decide to go in a slightly different direction with their culture.
What do we know about where the Native American Indian tribes did spring from out of the Hopewell culture? Is that what is surmised at this point?
What came after? Yeah, one of the biggest unanswered questions is what happened to the Hopewell? Archaeologically speaking, it seems to very abruptly end at about 400 to 450 AD, and then people don't seem to build any more earthworks, at least not geometric enclosures and such, and it doesn't seem like they go back to the earthworks too terribly much, although there is a sort of a revisiting of burying the dead in mounds that's been called the intrusive mound culture. But they're going back to some old mounds and using those for burial, the tops of the mounds.
There are other cultures that have disappeared very suddenly, too, or at least the manifestation of the cultures stopped.
Yeah, and I don't think it's probably untypical of cultures around the world. There are rises and falls that have to do with all sorts of factors. And in most cases, I don't think it's such a complicated set of factors that we can't say it's warfare or it's an environmental change. It's probably a combination of factors.
Yeah, so if you look at the biological Hopewell and where they came from and what happened to them, that biological population seems to carry through from the beginning through the end. It's the same community of folks, but the material remains related to their daily life. That changes gradually over time. And that's what archaeologists spend a lot of time studying, so it looks like these things just vanish when in fact they don't.
The geometry of the earthworks, particularly around Newark, is supposed to be astounding, the accuracy, particularly in how large they were and still how accurate they were. Brad, what is the significance of the geometry? You've already mentioned there's squares and circles and octagons and that kind of a thing.
Well, I guess there's two ways of looking at that. The significance for the people that built the mounds, I'm not sure what the significance was. But for us as archaeologists, I think the significance is that even though this was a society that apparently had no written records, we have no evidence of a system of writing, and yet they had this very sophisticated understanding of geometry and could build monumental architecture on a scale and a precision that seems astonishing to us. But I think that just reflects our cultural bias. You know, we sort of think of them, I think typically as naked savages, and how could they possibly have done this? Well, people in ancient Greece and Rome at about the same time period were doing wonderful things, and we don't think it's astonishing that they built the Parthenon and the Colosseum. So from that perspective, it's not all that astonishing that Native American peoples here in Ohio could build and could understand geometry and astronomy and incorporate that in monumental architecture.
Geophysical survey instruments are now being used to search for these earthworks, and you were talking about it earlier, Jared, that just because you can't see them above ground doesn't mean there isn't, it's that they've been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
They're still part, they're remnants, and there's still parts of them underground. What have you learned from the work that you do that way?
Basically, that we really don't know what's out there. So as part of my daily job, I roam around Ohio and elsewhere doing these geophysical surveys, often in cemeteries looking for unmarked graves. But my personal research takes me to some of these earthwork sites, and not only have we found that they're often more complex and still there, even if you can't see them, but we have discovered accidentally whole new earthwork complexes when we weren't even looking for them. So who knows how many more earthworks could actually be out there.
We're going to be meeting Chief Glenna Wallace. She's chief of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma in a few minutes. What happens nowadays when you do find a new earthwork? You don't dig in anymore, right?
Oh, not typically. In the cases where we have found new earthworks, they've not been a part of a project where there's some kind of development necessarily that's going to happen.
Okay.
But we certainly get them, tell people about what we found and let it be known very quickly that there's something significant there so that hopefully development in the future will go around it. And in fact, a lot of Ohio's earthworks have been recorded, their locations, and most folks try to avoid those in road projects or whatnot. But sometimes they can't be avoided, and archaeology has to be done to sort of mitigate the impact of the development.
But if it can be avoided, then the process isn't now to go in and dig things up and look at them.
Well, I would like to say that the process is not to go and dig up everything.
Okay.
Certainly, right now, archaeological excavation may be surgically targeted towards just doing a profile of one of the embankments or something like that is an important way still to learn about these sites. But no, we no longer just go in and dig up everything. We preserve the sites. But you fundamentally have to ask yourself, why are we preserving them? And I think one of the reasons is so that we can continue to study them.
Mm-hmm. I thought, Jared, it was interesting. You noted somewhere that in early June, when the wheat in the field is just starting to turn brown, is one of the best times for seeing earthworks, because the earthworks, the wheat on top of the earthworks, doesn't turn brown.
Sure, yeah.
Why is that?
Well, one component of a lot of these earthworks are ditches. So these are depressions dug into the ground. They've become filled with soil since then, but those ditches still hold water differently.
Okay.
So they're like mini rain basins, and so the wheat on top of those ditches stays green for just a week or two longer. And if you happen to be in an airplane flying over Ohio the first week of June, you might just spot an earthwork that nobody really knew was there. So a lot of folks surf around on Google Earth trying to, you know, locate new things that nobody knew about, and it can happen for sure.
There's still a lot more to discover than you think.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And the technology that Jared uses and his tireless efforts in the field, it's a revolution in archaeology, what Jared's been able to do here for Ohio.
Yeah, I don't spend a whole lot of time at Newark because it's quite easy to see those earthworks
uh-huh.
that are still preserved. I spend a lot of my time at these invisible sites. And what keeps me going is that every day at the end of the day when I download the data from the instruments, there could be a new discovery waiting that nobody has really seen for 1,700 years.
So do you have a tally of how many earthworks you've discovered that haven't been documented?
Like entire sites?
No,
it would be
new...
two new sites. And as far as new enclosures,
yeah.
I've lost track. It's several dozen probably by now. So these are old sites that we knew were there, but there are whole new circles or other kinds of shapes. I hate to say it, but I think my name has become attached to this term squircle.
Squircle?
it's sort of a square with rounded corners.
Okay.
And the more of these geophysical surveys I do, the more that we're discovering that this was a shape that was really common in Ohio, but somehow in the 19th century they were recorded as squares or circles. Squire and Davis totally missed the Squircle Revolution.
So that would be how many sides for?
It's a square with just slightly rounded corners.
Okay.
Yeah.
Squircle. Okay.
Well, it's a real word. Look it up.
I believe you. We are talking about the Ohio Earthworks. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Coming up, Glenna Wallace, chief of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the Newark Earthworks in Licking County and the Ohio Earthworks in general. It is the one in Licking County. It's the largest complex of geometric earthen enclosures ever built by the Hopewell culture some 14,000 years ago. There are no federally recognized Native tribes based in Ohio today, but in recent years, the Eastern Shawnee have brought tribe members to Ohio to take in the experience of the Hopewell culture by way of the Newark Earthworks. Joining us now to talk about that by phone from Oklahoma is Chief Glenna Wallace of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. I particularly appreciate the invitation to be a part of it.
Our pleasure. Can you tell us a bit about the Shawnee role in Ohio history and how it fits together from where you sit?
Well, there are three federally recognized Shawnee tribes, all located here in Oklahoma. All of us were there in Ohio back in the 1700s, and I can speak only for the Eastern Shawnee tribe. The Indian Removal Act was passed in 1830. At the time that it was passed in 1817, we had been placed on one of three reservations there in Ohio, and our reservation was the Lewistown Reservation. It was the Lewistown Reservation that was the first group of people to be removed forcibly from Ohio after that Indian Removal Act was passed. We lived there with another group of Indians that are the Seneca Cayuga, who are also located here in Oklahoma, and we were known as the Mixed Band. So in 1832, it was the Mixed Band that was the first group to be relocated, and so the two of us together walked the more than 700 miles to be relocated here, what would be Indian territory, and then would be come the state of Oklahoma. So we have been here since 1832, but we also know that our homelands were Ohio. So obviously we are interested in what was there when our people were forced to leave. Those are our ancestors. That is our heritage. And we're vitally interested in what goes on there.
Your groups, you and your groups just started to visit the site a few years back, right?
That's correct.
How did that come about?
Well, it actually came about, first we had planned, we had wanted a trip back to Ohio for a long, long time, but we were not financially able. We could have sent one person or two people. We've gone to conferences. Various chiefs have gone back for various activities, but we wanted to take as many of our tribal citizens as who wanted to come. And so first we had to have the financial ability to do so. Oklahoma, when we came here, has never been a place that has been particularly financially rewarding to Native Americans through the Dust Bowl days, through the migration to California, Oregon, Washington. And when such things as the oil boom came, it didn't really affect Native Americans because Native Americans, although they were given land when they first came to Indian territory, when the allotment came into being, the land went to individual tribal people and not to Indian tribes as such. So consequently, Indian tribes have not had fantastic wealth means until the advent of casinos, and we happen to have a casino, and we've been very frugal in managing the profits from that casino and giving it back to tribal members. And we wanted our tribal members to regain their heritage, to learn more of their culture, their history, and Ohio was the place that we needed to go to do that. So in 2007, we made our first trip back to Ohio. At that time, we really were not concentrating upon mounds. We were just simply interested in Ohio, and we truly had to lean upon people there from Ohio to even tell us about our own history. When we returned there, well, then we began learning on our own, and it occurred quite by accident. There was a famous author by the name of John Sugden who had written a book about Tecumseh, and he was giving a lecture at Ohio State University in 2008. I traveled to Ohio specifically to listen to John Sugden talk about Tecumseh. One of the requirements that Ohio State University had that in that lectureship series, people were taken out to Newark Earthworks. And so because I was there to hear John Sugden, I went out to Newark Earthworks. I had never heard of it before, had never read of it before. Have actually been privileged in my life because of job responsibilities I had at a community college where one of my duties was director of international travel, that I had traveled to 70 foreign countries, and our purpose was always to go to cultural sites, to go to significant places. And I was astounded when I went to Newark Earthworks and stood there, saw what was there, and could not believe my eyes, because here I was reading everything I could throughout the world. Here I was Native American. Here I was Shawnee. And I knew nothing of any of this. And I was amazed. I was absolutely astounded. And then I had other emotions that came along as well. I became angry that the Newark Earthworks is located where there is a golf course, where they're playing golf on top of those mounds or around those mounds. I became angry that Native Americans did not have significant, adequate rights to even visit their heritage or to know about it. And I vowed at that moment that I would become more active and do what I could to preserve those earthworks and to make them known throughout the United States and particularly to Native Americans.
When your groups visit the sites, what do you do?
Well, again, when we visit the sites, about all we can do, unless it's a particular day when we can go there, we can only stand at the side and look. We can see very little. We can look, watch videos. We last time that we were there, this is our third trip now that we have made back to Ohio. We came in 2007, 2009, and then in 2013, just this past summer. And at this last time, well, we had specific permission where we could go, and then I have become involved in the movement to our journey to have the earthworks, along with other mounds there in Ohio, recognized as part of the World Heritage. And so then we were actually able to go on to the earthwork site and actually able to walk around. That's the first time as a group that that's been done.
Brad Lepper, having members of the Eastern Shawnee visiting the site and becoming involved and caring about it and making that connection, what does that mean to you as a curator of archaeology for the Ohio Historical Society?
It's been a tremendous honor to work with Chief Glenna to share what we've learned and what we've preserved for these earthworks, you know, with the Shawnee. But it's been something that's been lacking, and it's really vital, and it's been very exciting for me to have a Native American presence on these sites, to hear drumming and singing and so on take place. It's, I mean, the question of a direct connection between the Shawnee and the Hopewell culture is something, as Chief Glenn acknowledges, is in question. Certainly there's a Native American connection there, but still, regardless, to have Eastern Woodland Indians back on the site, it's just really exciting and deeply moving.
We have an email from Matthew. He writes, "This is such a fascinating subject. I can't believe that as a lifelong Ohio resident, this is the first I have heard about the earthworks and their significance. I am dumbfounded that this subject was never mentioned during history class. Is there an effort to bring this into Ohio's K-12 curriculum?" Brad?
Absolutely. We've been doing our best for years. Some schools incorporate it. Of course, since social studies is no longer tested, often teachers today don't find the opportunity to include it in their curriculum.
How could that possibly be?
I cannot imagine in my wildest dreams how that could be excluded from the testing.
Chief, to what extent is the history of the earthworks and the connections that you're still working on finding part of the educational process for people in the Eastern Shawnee tribe?
When we were removed from Ohio and we came to Indian Territory and Oklahoma then, just before the year 1900, our numbers dwindled to only 69 tribal people. With 69 tribal people, we have to be honest and say we lost almost everything. We lost our language. We lost our culture. We lost our history. We lost knowledge of who our ancestors were. We had not been back to Ohio as a tribe. Some had never been there. So our knowledge of the earthworks would be very similar to the email that you just read. Mm-hmm. It was zero, and we are struggling to learn as much as we can, not only about the mounds and the earthworks there in Ohio, but all of our history there in Ohio. We're making efforts on several fronts. The Ohio Historical Society is obviously very involved in this, and we appreciate their cooperation. At a time when we had no contact whatsoever with Ohio Historical Society, since that visit that I made there in 2008, I've been rather relentless in continuing to contact them, and they have seen the value and recognized the part that Native Americans play in that. Brad is correct. The Eastern Shawnee do not maintain that our people were the ones who built the earthworks. We maintain that our people protected the earthworks. They were there. They recognized the dignity of them. They recognized the solemnity of the mounds. And we're particularly interested in, we had a talk with another person outside of the Ohio Historical Society, Marty Chotsmith, who's very involved in preserving the earthworks there. And she's said it would be fascinating to go back to all of the languages and see how many of the Indian languages have words for mounds. We certainly aren't going to have those words for squircle, that we know.
Darn.
But that doesn't mean that we don't always see need for things that didn't exist in the language there. And so we do have that word in our language, you know. So we're pleased to, one of the things that's happening right now is that Ohio seems to know some, not all, about our history. As the gentleman indicated in his email, he'd never heard of the earthwork mound, so Ohio doesn't teach everything about the Native American history. But here in Oklahoma, we tend to dwell more upon the present, and so a grant has been written where we are matching some fourth grade teachers here in Oklahoma with fourth grade teachers there in Ohio, and we're merging that history. So we're working on those on several fronts, and working with the Ohio Historical Society, with the national parks, all of that. Those are methods that we are using to teach not only our tribe and our citizens, but other tribes and the United States as a whole. And with World Heritage, it would go beyond the United States as a whole, but to the world as a whole.
Chief, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it very much.
Chief Glenna Wallace. She's chief of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma. Also with us today, Dr. Jared Burks, director of archaeological geophysics at Ohio Valley Archaeology, and Dr. Bradley Lepper, curator of archaeology at the Ohio Historical Society. Thanks to you both for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.